Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This week we're hitting the streets and knocking on doors to find out what it really takes to win an election. Our guides are Mark Pack and Ed Maxfield, whose book, 101 Ways to Win an Election, is out now in its third edition and contains literally everything you need to know to take your place on that council seat, as indeed Ed did 4 years ago. Without further ado, welcome both.
Mark Pack and Ed Maxfield, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Lovely to be with you, Vicky.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Thank you very much for coming on both. We're here to chat about your book, 101 Ways to Win an Election, which basically is a very handy how-to guide of everything you need to know should you wish to run for any kind of political office. So let's get cracking and kind of dive in the deep end and ask, what inspired you guys to write the first edition? Because this is the third one. Why did you decide to write it? How did you get into politics? How did you research the book? Because there's some very in-depth stuff in there.
Well, it's 9 years ago. So I guess what, 10 or 11 years since we decided to write it. So I'm not sure I can remember. but actually, one of the things I do remember, Ed and I had a coffee in Waterstones, in fact, appropriately, a bookshop, one of the nice Waterstones in central London. And we both, I think, Ed, we quite wanted to write a book. We're both a little bit old-fashioned in that sense, if Ed doesn't mind me putting it that way, that the idea of having actually a printed book with your name on the cover, that sort of quite appealed to us to have a go at that. And we were also both then, as now, very busy people. So we deliberately went for a topic, tried to think of a topic that wouldn't require us to do lots of original research, but we could write from our own experience and have to look things up and, you know, dig out bits of nice quotes and the like to improve the text, but that fundamentally it would be, in that sense, like writing a memoir, that you don't have to go and research new stuff to find it out, but you're trying to find interesting ways of recounting what you already know. That's my memory, Ed. Anyway, I don't. Your memory might be completely different. It might not even involve a coffee in Waterstones. It was so long ago.
I definitely remember the coffee. No, I think that's right. And I think the other thing which sort of went towards it was actually Mark's being a bit not giving himself enough credit, I think, because he I think was the one who came up with the idea of the format and borrowed from a book that I think he'd read sort of fairly recent to that. And I think the combined sort of appeal of having something that was kind of digestible for people that they could dip into and take an idea away from each chapter was really appealing. And I think fits with what we were trying to achieve as well. And because obviously, you know, to increase your chances of winning, obviously we would say it would be best if you read all 101 chapters and took the lessons from all of them. But
in all three editions, stuff, obviously, to maximize.
Absolutely, all 303 chapters, that's right, yeah. But, you know, the kind of whole nugget idea was quite appealing. And I think the other thing, to be honest, was that the fact that the chapters that we were writing were essentially the length of what I think now we can call a traditional blog post, not that anyone writes blog posts anymore, was also quite appealing because we felt that that made it transferable into sort of digital media as well very easily. So I think it was those, that was the other side of the decision to do it, was not just the fact that so much of it was translating our personal experience onto the page. It was also just the format was really appealing as well.
It was also one of the factors was that both Ed and I have been used to ghostwriting for others, things like newspaper columns, which are typically the length of one of the chapters. And so there was a bit of a sense of, which I think is, you know, the key to any book that's going to be, you know, even marginally successful, of what's the overlap between what we're used to and what we think we know how to do and what the reader might want. And I think having those digestible chapters made it a lot easier to write, definitely, because it was like writing 101 newspaper columns rather than starting with a complete blank sheet of paper to write a whole book. But I think for the reader, certainly this is a lot of the feedback, you know, I think both Ed and I have had from readers, is they really like the fact that they can dip in and out of it. You can maybe spend an evening campaigning for your own preferred political party or candidate, and then read one or two chapters over a cup of coffee at the end of the day while you're letting the blisters on your feet heal a bit. So that works, I think, really nicely for both authors and readers, and it's that overlap that's crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, one of the nice things about the book is that it literally is a very... like a comprehensive list of everything you need to know about campaigning, which I'm sure is like extremely helpful for anyone who's ever been door knocking or even running a campaign, to be honest, because they are massive unwieldy things that I'm sure can get extremely complicated very quickly. And I just want to kind of ask quickly what got you both interested in politics, I guess, but more specifically the science of elections?
Well, I don't know about Mark, but for me, I've always said that there was a kind of fork in the road in my life when I was a teenager, where it was essentially a choice between a hobby that involved train spotting or a hobby that involved getting involved in elections. And I ended up doing the elections thing. So I'd love to say, from my own personal point of view, it was some great political campaign against some injustice, but actually it was just my next door neighbour was a Liberal Party candidate in the local elections, and he asked me to deliver some leaflets. And from that point on, I was
so
hooked.
Easily, Ed could have been the author of 101 steam engines, couldn't you?
I certainly could. I could very easily have done exactly that. Yeah. So no, I mean, it's a great lesson actually for anybody who is looking to expand their the pool of people who are involved. I mean, it was literally the case that my next door neighbour was a candidate in a local election and asked me to deliver some leaflets. And obviously, you know, there must have been something there. I must have been interested to a certain extent. But that's what captured me. That's what caught me. That's where I got the bug and started to learn more about it myself, not just elections, but politics in general. And it kind of went from there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the answer is in my case, because I guess there were several different organisations, including the Lib Dems, that I was involved in as a student and, you know, active in and doing campaigning in different forms, like Amnesty International was one, and doing campaigning with Amnesty International, which is very different from campaigning for a political party, but it's a similar sort of motivation and enjoyment that you can get from it. I think the reason it ended up with politics so dominating is that political parties have a lot more gradations to them. It's a lot easier to get involved and then get a bit more involved and then a bit more involved, whilst, you know, even organisations...
Sometimes it's hard to get less involved. Well, you know, escaping is never that easy. Yeah, but, sorry, go on.
Organisations like Amnesty International, say, which I'm still an Amnesty member and so on, but I'm not, you know, really particularly active in... They have local groups, and you can get involved in running your local group. And then there's a big leap, really, from if you're doing something at group level to maybe running for the national board. And there aren't that many volunteer roles in between the two. There are some. That's, I think, true. There's still a volunteer network, for example. But with political parties, there are a lot more gradations. So I think it's quite easy to, yeah, get drawn into or slip into doing more and more. But I think the thing that particularly appealed to me about, and I think that partly this is about politics in general, but also I think specifically around being a Lib Dem campaigner, especially in the 1990s, was the sense that you can run a campaign that really completely upends last time's result and somebody different gets elected very directly because of the effort that you and your colleagues put in. There's a real sense of being able to bring about change in a way that... You know, with all due respect to Ed, whether or not Ed is a councillor matters a lot less than, say, whether an Amnesty prisoner of conscience stopped being tortured. You know, those two. But it's much more direct, the sense of satisfaction and the sense of real agency that you get from the campaign on an election. You can see the connection between your efforts and shaping the result in a way that other campaigning is massively important and valuable, but you have much less of that sense of agency, I think. Didn't put in the book at all, did we, Ed? We're going to have to write a petition. We're notes here for some extra chapters on how to involve people.
Yeah, I still sort of make notes on, I wish we'd included that.
That could be the premium edition.
I'm not sure if it's a burden or a benefit that the 101 title restricts us. So it's something we had to do for this version. There's lots of new stuff in. And I think the word count is definitely larger than the previous edition. A bit like fiction authors, each book seems to get longer. but but we did have to stick to 101 chapters. We've cheated slightly in one section that was a numbered chapter previously, is no longer a numbered chapter. But and that was quite a good discipline, and I hope that's something the readers will appreciate. Yeah. That not just the book gets bloated by adding in more and more stuff. We've had to be quite tough about how do we keep to 101 and a little bit on extra things.
Yes, well, everyone keep your eyes peeled for 2023 when 105 ways to win an election will be coming up. So you guys have been in politics, you know, for quite a long time. Ed, you're a councillor, and Mark, you said you were, you know, door knocking in 1990. So I wanted to know, like, how have elections and campaigning, how has that changed since you wrote the first edition of your book?
That's a good question. I guess in many ways, surprisingly little. I mean, a lot of the mechanics have changed a lot. You know, in the Lib Dems, we do almost all of our canvassing now using apps on smartphones. And so the old style of printing off canvas cards and having to print off multiple copies, all of that has gone. And in fact, you know, it wasn't that many years before I started where the norm was actually printed electoral registers, which would be cut up and glued onto bits of cardboard to create your literal canvas card. So a lot of the mechanics have changed massively, but I think the underlying principles have remained much the same, with I think maybe one difference, which is the slightly depressing one, that being a liar seems to matter less. You know, and yeah, we're recording this just after Matt Hancock had to resign as health secretary. And I do think the fumbling, well, I say fumbling, but probably deliberately disingenuous answer the Prime Minister gave at the weekend, where, you know, he had clearly not required Hancock's resignation. He had said the day, you know, on the Friday, he had, you know, you can stay. And then on Saturday, Hancock decided to go. And the Prime Minister said, well, you know, the news broke on Friday and he was gone by Saturday, trying to imply that somehow he had actually taken action as opposed to simply being happy with Hancock to try to stay in post. And I think that sort of disingenuousness and often outright dishonesty does seem to be more widespread amongst even successful politicians. I think, yeah, there often have been very, you know, dishonest people in politics, as in all professions, in the past, but there does seem to be a sense that people can get away with it rather more. And I think that's one of the things we've tried to explain a little bit in the book about how do you tackle that sort of appeal and understanding why people might still vote for somebody who they fundamentally think is dishonest.
Yeah, it's interesting to be sort of pushed to answer that question, actually, because I thinking about it, I think there are probably three things which are kind of in the process of changing, which everyone is, maybe not everyone, but lots of us are still trying to work out how to deal with. One, I think, is digital communications, which is obviously changing very rapidly and has changed hugely, even since we wrote the first edition of the book. The second is that thing, I'll be a bit more generous than Mark, rather than talk about lying, maybe say the resurgence of values as a way of doing politics, whatever those values are, you know, the fronting essentially populism or, you know, of the left or right or whatever, has come back into fashion, perhaps in politics in a way that it kind of got lost in the sort of post-war decades. And I think there's, and I'm talking here, I guess, principally about the UK, but also the United States and mainland Europe. So there's lots of interesting issues there where I think lots of people involved in politics haven't really worked out how to deal with that and how to do politics in that environment. So digital comms and values are important. The third one, which it almost feels like it's gone full circle, is the use of data more broadly. Certainly when Mark and I were working together, you know, I think we as an organisation were a kind of at the leading edge in terms in British politics in using data to get our message across as effectively and efficiently as we possibly could. And it feels like it's kind of gone back into the drawer a little bit since then, simply because it's so much harder to get access to people's data because of all the legal changes. So it's, and possibly also that values thing, you know, that it's kind of pushed it off the agenda a little bit. But you know, that I find that really interesting, that that's kind of feels like it's gone a little bit in full circle, and I kind of miss it because I enjoyed playing with data. But I think those three things are things that have changed but are still changing, and I'm not sure that, certainly I don't have the answers into how to cope with all of them.
Yeah, for sure. And the values thing is very interesting, because I've not lived through a lot of elections, but it does feel like they are progressively becoming higher stakes with each one that rolls around. It's like a battle for how you want to see the UK and, yeah, the kind of the UK that you're voting for. So your book is called 101 Ways to Win an Election. So to ask the obvious question, I suppose, how should you go about running an election?
Shall I have a go first?
It's weighty subject. You got it. Yeah.
You've got to, as long as you include the phrase kill trees.
Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing is to understand the voters. And one of the defining characteristics of most voters, nearly every voter, in fact, is they don't pay very much attention to politics. And that's not because people are stupid. If you think about people getting excited around the last England-Germany football match and the amount of knowledge that people have of the history of previous football matches, the details of different tactical formations, etc. There's a huge amount of knowledge that people apply to things they're really passionate about. But people like Ed and myself are a little bit unusual to have politics as a thing we're passionate about. So most voters don't pay that much attention to politics, and therefore successful campaigns have to both find ways of grabbing their attention and getting persuasive messages through, even though you've not got much of a slice of somebody's attention to work with, but also understanding therefore what matters and what doesn't matter, because lots of things that people get very excited about, if you're really into politics, just really pass most voters by. So if you think about politics in Britain in the last year, I mean, all sorts of drama, all sorts of excitement, all sorts of genuine importance if you're really into the details. If you ask members of the public what they remember from the last year, well, there'd be something around Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle, almost certainly. They probably will remember things like Boris Johnson falling ill with coronavirus himself, that Labour has got a new leader. But even then, beyond those three things, a lot of people will probably begin to struggle to mention very much. So understanding and respecting, not looking down on voters, but respecting the fact that they're just busy, interested in other things. So how do you, how seeing things through their eyes is really important. What do you want to add anything to that, Ed? I've given one, so there must be at least 100 things you could add.
Well, I was thinking as you were answering that actually that fundamental point actually leads into so many of the other points that we make in the book, which you know, around the importance of having thinking carefully about your message. And how you think about that in terms of, you know, the issues that voters will actually really care about, and how much effort it actually takes to shift voters' opinions. So much of it flows from that basic point that, in general, politics is a lot less important to the bulk of the electorate, not just the electorate, but people who vote as well, you know, than it is to the likes of Mark and me, you know, that they don't spend that much time thinking about it or absorbing the details. And I'm not sure if we're allowed to mention other authors, but it was really interesting.
Whether they're signed to bite back or not, I guess.
Yeah, by all means.
Well, there was a really interesting piece where I heard John Harris being interviewed a couple of days ago, where, you know, he was talking about the sorts of things that people, there's obviously a lot of attention focused on the red wall and the loss of the sort of breakdown of support, working class support for Labour. And he was making the point about the sorts of things that people care about are, you know, really basic things about their own community, and, you know, whether there are lots of empty shops where they live, and whether they feel a sense of affinity with their community. And I just thought, yeah, you know, we talk a lot about the real detail nitty-gritty and policy detail and concern about particular issues and campaigns, but fundamentally people in general see politics through that prism, which is, how does it affect me, my family and my community? Do I feel good about those things or not? And depending on what your sort of political philosophy is, will determine how you come at those issues, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose regardless of party, the most important thing is convincing voters that they can trust you and that you can deliver the vision that they want for the future. With that in mind, like, what's the biggest mistake that most people or parties indeed, like, that they make before running? Why do people fail when they run for election?
I don't think we preserved it. I think we ditched it from the later editions. But and I'm quite glad, actually, because I really like Kelsey Grammer. So I'm gonna dob Kelsey Grammer in here, the American actor. I remember seeing at the time we were writing the first edition of the book, he's a Republican, and he was quite open about his ambition to get involved in politics, in essentially to run for elected office in the United States. And I read an interview with him where he talked about his ambition to do that entirely bounded by his own ambition and his own, you know, his own motivations, essentially. And I thought at the time, that's fine. That's good to know that that's what motivates him, but I'm not sure it's going to motivate many voters. I think so. The fundamental thing to get right, I think personally, as you approach politics and an election, is to remember that it's about the motivations and needs of the voters, not your own career. And I think if you start from that position, then it goes quite a long way to making sure that you get stuff right as you go along.
I guess the thing I would add to that is that if you're not really into politics, into political campaigning more specifically, the impression you can get of what political campaigns are like and what matters and so on through either media coverage or through fiction is often massively misleading. I mean, there was an absolutely bizarrely hilarious council election that featured in EastEnders a few years ago, where getting elected to the council involved going to the town hall and meeting some important people. Just you sort of think, how do the script writers know enough to connect election with town hall, but not then want to put in any modicum of basic plausibility to that bit of the plot? But also, if you think about fictional accounts of elections, or indeed non-fictional accounts, they're very dominated by America. Now, obviously, if you're an American listening to this, our book is still massively relevant. So please, please buy it. Please read it. But a lot of American political campaigning is very different from, say, in Britain, because of TV advertising is legal and things like volunteer delivery networks operating all year round isn't something you get in the US. So it's a very different. And I think we make the point in one of the chapters in the book, there's several key roles in a political campaign that never feature in the Hollywood movies about election campaigns. So I think it's a very different skill to learn, even if you pay attention to politics and you know which was the swing state in the southern USA that Biden won by a knife edge, and you've, you know, seen some fictional accounts of elections and so on. There's a lot still to learn about what really makes a good campaign tick.
Yes, absolutely, which is why you should buy the book.
As well as being a not very successful Republican candidate, Kelsey Grammer also featured in a really good but fairly obscure TV series about being a mayor of Chicago. I think it is called The Boss. I think it only lasted 3 seasons. But actually, in terms of, yeah, with all the exaggerations of fiction and understanding of what politics when you're in office is like, it's not a bad series. I wouldn't recommend watching it to learn how to win elections, but maybe watch it to get a few ideas about what it's like then being in office. But definitely would recommend that obscure TV series to people.
Yeah. Well, also, having listened to his Desert Island Disc episode, I think I would have voted for him as well. He sounds like a really nice guy.
You would have voted for a Republican, Ed.
Well, you know,
I think you're following the arc of getting more right wing as you get older, clearly.
Absolutely. I hold it in mind, the Dennis Healey quote about if you're not a communist when you're young, you've got no heart. And if you're not a conservative, when you get old, you've got no head. So there you go.
Well, yes, watch that and then watch Veep. And I feel like between the two, there's a very good representation of American politics there.
It did also put me in mind that the last, talking about jobs that don't, in politics, that don't get covered on the TV, I think the first job that I had at the last parliamentary by-election that I went to help in was taking a hose pipe to the outside toilet. So in a vain attempt to clean it. But
now you're a councillor, so I feel like up and up.
My
favourite memory of weird by-election tasks like that was a colleague drilling some holes in the ceiling so the water could come through and wouldn't just accumulate on the ceiling and make the ceiling collapse. It was a very rundown building we were renting for that by-election HQ.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like the thick of it. I lie.
My favourite memory is in the Ipswich by-election. So over your way, where near where you are now, Ed. In whenever it was, must have been early this century. And we knew that we would probably finish second and a decent second, but it would take a bit of explaining to party members, etc., why they should be really pleased with the result. So we were all set up to do what was fairly innovative in those days of sending emails out immediately after the result. So sending emails out overnight to people explaining the result and why they should be happy with it. And I remember, because it was dial-up modems in those days, in the early hours of 3, 4 a.m., desperately having to reconnect and reconnect to resend more emails. And eventually the gas cylinder that was heating this cold building ran out. And of course, the agent had been so parsimonious with the money, rightly so, that he had timed it perfectly so that that was the last gas cylinder we had anywhere in the building. So sending out the last emails, getting increasingly cold. But that's not quite the glamour of politics. But I think the serious point about actually both Ed's experience with the outside toilet and my experience with the annoying disconnecting modem is that a lot of this is fun. And it's fun that comes from working with colleagues in slightly weird and bizarre and testing circumstances. But when you have a bigger common purpose, that really makes it worthwhile. And that's why you carry on coming back for more. And there's a lovely story we've got in the book of a probably apocryphal story that Tony Benn used to tell about meeting somebody and asking them what they were, what they were doing. And, one chap said that he was sort of, building. And the other chap said he was helping make a cathedral. And that's the difference between a team having a vision and a team not having a vision.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the nice thing about politics and, it's basically an arena like no other, isn't it? It's thrills and spills and highs and lows, like I don't think you get in many other jobs. So I could quiz you guys for hours on the ins and outs, the wisdom you guys have to dispense on elections. But as we come to the end of our half hour podcast, I think I'll just have to ask you, what's one thing you hope people will take away from reading your book?
Obviously, one of the audiences for the book is anyone who might be interested in standing for office or running a campaign and so on themselves. But I genuinely think it's of interest to people who would just follow politics a bit. And I think, it's interesting to know how politics works. Just as if you're maybe a sports fan, you might want to read a book about football tactics or how managers motivate their teams. If you want to know a bit more about what really goes on inside these operations, why do people do the apparently bizarre, baffling things that they do? And hopefully our book gives people a bit of a sense of what really goes on in politics, and maybe gives you a sense of why did that politician say that weird thing or make that odd decision last week. Hope the book gives you a way of helping understand what might have been going through their mind, what the electoral calculations might have been. And sometimes you might still think that what they did was weird and inexplicable, because politicians do weird, inexplicable stuff at times, but quite often it will hopefully illuminate what's going on and give you a bit of a better understanding as to why people are doing what they're doing.
Yeah, so I should have gone first and I've let you steal all the good bits. Because, I mean, there is, it is fun, it is worthwhile. And as you said, it's also, there's the kind of buzz to it. I mean, the great difference between, for me, having worked in the charity campaigning sector, as well as in sort of electoral politics, the huge difference is that there's a very hard deadline, which gives you which gives you a binary result. You know, you either win or you lose, and the margins between the two are often very small. And I think if I was going to say what people should take away, apart from that sense that it's actually worth getting involved in, is an understanding of how many people, because this is a thing I don't think most people realise, is actually how many different people have contributed to understanding it. Because it's the nature of the format of our book that we have been, you know, we have approached it as a couple of magpies, really. We deliberately pinched lots of people, other people's good ideas. And so I think if I was going to read it as a kind of an outsider, not necessarily looking to for it as a kind of to provide me with a game plan, I'd be really curious to know more about some of the people that we quote in the book as having looked at various aspects of how you do it and why you do it and how it works and how it doesn't work.
Great, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If hearing Mark and Ed speak about campaigning has sparked your interest, then why not check out their book? 101 Ways to Win an Election is out now and available from all good bookshops. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.